You know, there are a lot of ways that I come up with the kinds of things that I'm going to talk about. And this last week, I talked with the wife of a man who had kidney failure. She was crying. She was upset. He was about to go on dialysis. In case you're wondering, about 24% of the people who go on dialysis each year die. It's not a real good treatment, but it does keep you alive for a little while. Average life expectancy once you go on is 5.7 years. I know a lot of stuff about that. But she was crying because he wouldn't go on the diet. Now, there's a diet that you can go on that'll keep you from going on dialysis. But it involves becoming a vegetarian. Horror of horrors, and then limiting, depending on how bad you are, how much veggies you eat. How many. And so she said, he just has no self-control. I can't get him. That's the whole point of self-control. I can't get him to do what he has to do. Self-control is just that. You have to have it. You're the ones who have to do it. Now, as you think about diet for a person facing dialysis, well, they're facing pretty certain death pretty soon. You know, it's not going to be long before they're going to be gone. They're going to face God, and shortly. And that brings us to the heart of this matter of self-control. In Acts the 24th chapter and verse 25, Paul was discussing righteousness, self-control, and judgment to come. Felix became frightened and said, go away for the present. When I find time, I will summon you. And so as we think about this self-control that was frightening him, what do we find there? Well, we look at that Greek and we say, okay, that's Greek to me. In the King James Version, it's sometimes rendered as temperance. That is, the ability to draw back from strong drink, as some people look at it. The idea is self-mastery, self-restraint. And Thayer says it's equally well established in the classics and the Septuagint. In the verbal form, it is found in Genesis 43:31, for the self-restraint exercised by Joseph in the presence of his brethren. He controlled himself. He was talking to his brethren, didn't want them to know. But there was another thing that brought this to my mind this week, and that is this guy, Walter Mischel, has just put out a book. And he's known as the marshmallow psychologist. Now, we're going to learn something from this. And you may think, well, what does this have to do with it? Well, he says, it's a more widespread perception that the world is more and more one in which people are orientated to immediate gratification. Boy, is that ever true. And don't know how to delay it. But when you look closely, I think that's probably not the case. I disagree with this guy about that, however. You're going to see why. If anything, there's been improvement in overall self-control. Really? Well, okay. We'll think about this. He says that children, and I think this is probably because of video games, are developing the skills to delay gratification very well. That ability, psychologists call it executive control, shows whether they can keep a goal in mind. Now, you look at a kid playing a video game, and I mean they're sitting there, they're not paying any attention to anything that's going on, they're thumbing it. That's why they don't hit with one finger. Got to use two. They have to suppress impulses that interfere with reaching that goal. In other words, they have to shut out extraneous noises. They're learning how to concentrate. And they use attention control abilities in the brain's prefrontal cortex, if you're into that kind of thing, to keep marching on until they reach the goal. Isn't that interesting? Back in the 1960s at Stanford University, Mischel says, we set up a study using preschool children and gave them a choice between one reward, say a marshmallow, that they could have immediately, or they could get two if they waited for up to 20 minutes. You may have heard me talk about this before. You've probably heard about it. There was a bell to ring to call a researcher back into the room if they wanted to eat the first reward. We observed the behavior of kids who managed to wait. And the first thing they did was transform the situation from an effortful one to a much easier one. Well, how did they cope? They try to turn around in their chairs so they don't face the goodies. They look away or invent interesting things to do. For example, they begin to sing little songs or explore their nasal and ear canals and toy with whatever they discover. We can just imagine it, can't we? We see a steady progression over the early years from self-distraction to the use of abstraction. That is, they build pretend brick walls between themselves and the marshmallow or the goodies. They use imagination to cool the situation. We're beginning to understand now about, well, okay, we can see evidences of God and His will for us in this. He says one little girl who rang the bell in less than a minute, they ran a test to see if they could change how long she waited by changing how she thought about the cookies. If we suggested, for example, she should make believe they're not real, that they're just a picture, she could wait 15 minutes. Isn't that astounding? Just sit there and say, okay, I'm going to mentally say that it's not something that I really want to do. We learn that the way the object of desires appraised makes a huge difference. If I know I can't resist chocolate mousse on the dessert tray in a restaurant, I can devise a plan beforehand in which I imagine a cockroach nibbled on it before it was served to me. Then I've lost my desire for it instantly. You know, there are scientists who look at this 5-second rule, or some people call it, you know, you drop something on the floor. And then, well, it's only been 2 seconds or 5 seconds, or I can pick it up and eat it. Well, it's always got more bacteria on it. But one fellow sort of finished it when he said, you know, if you drop the most delicious piece of chocolate in the world in a pile of dog poo, you're not going to eat it. Period. You just think about it. You just sit there and say, no way I'm eating that thing. You wash it off and I'm not going to eat that thing. That's trash. Now you understand how to bring about self-control in your life. You don't eat trash, right? You understand. I've lost my desire for it instantly. It's nasty. Now you're getting it, brethren. Think about sin. It's nasty. He says, by the age of 25 to 30, we found the delayers were more able to reach long-term goals. They used risky drugs less. They achieved higher education levels and had a significantly lower body mass index. That's your weight. In 2009, we scanned delayers' brains and found more activity in the prefrontal cortex used for problem solving, creative thinking, and control of impulsive behavior. Don't give in to your impulses is what self-control is. So learning to delay gratification early correlates with success as an adult. That's in this life. And the techniques can be applied to everything from coping with heartbreak to weight control, retirement planning, and smoking. Boy, did he ever hit us all. You sit there and immediately you say, well, you mean all I have to do is imagine that a cockroach has been running? You know, there's a Chinese restaurant we used to go to on a regular basis out in Columbia. Nicole already started laughing. She was there the night the cockroach was in the fried rice. A cockroach. You know, we've never been back. No one has ever suggested, let's go out to that good Chinese restaurant. Do you understand about self-control and how to get it? Now, you're all sitting here and you're saying, wait a minute, is this man going to talk about fat now? I didn't have to. Michel said it. What about some bad habit that I have? What about smoking or drinking or drugs? All you have to do is realize what the true import of those things is, and you're going to say, I don't want that. You know, I had a kidney problem. Because of my diet, I don't have a kidney problem. But you know, it's terrible to go out to eat with me to a place like Carrabba's. They have the most wonderful chicken soup. I love it. It takes me over 30 minutes to eat a bowl because I've got to sit down and pick every little speck of chicken out of it. I look at that and I say, no, I'm not going to eat that, but I'll eat around it. Now, as you think about that, in your life, there's something that you're having trouble mastering. And some of those things are sinful. And you're going to say, I will master these. And of course, how we do it is it's going to have to be with the Lord's help. 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 8, one of my favorite verses. For bodily discipline is only of a little profit. You know, I've gotten off my exercise regimen. I'm doing a different kind of exercise, and so I got the bike out, And you know, it's not bad because as I take off from the house, there's a fairly steep hill and then it's downhill all the way to the shed. And so I can just coast. It's turning around and go back the other way that's tough. And as you think about bodily exercise, why would you do that? Well, I noticed I've got a knee that's getting worse and worse, and sooner or later it's going to have to be replaced, so I'm going to try to get that knee in better shape so that I don't have to have a surgeon put it in better shape for me. Perhaps I can do it. But on the other hand, I realize that godliness is profitable for all things, since it holds promise for the present life, and also for the life to come. Well, part of godliness, brethren, is self-control. In this life, self-control has unquestionable rewards. You look at someone who's grossly overweight and you say, oh my, they got a problem. Yes, it will manifest itself in certain ways. Certain of us recognize, now, turned out my father had diabetes. And so, a number of years ago, the doctors told me I was pre-diabetic. My son looked at me and he said, Dad, everybody's pre-diabetic if they don't have diabetes. Well, not really, but close. Some of you already have diabetes. And you're saying, it just is impossible for me to refuse to eat the chocolate. I just told you how you could stop it. Drop it just once. That's all you have to do. And then you won't eat it. It's easy. You think about heartbreak. There are people who, oh, I don't know how I live without that person in my life. Well, you're probably going to have to get a true picture of what that person's really like. I remember sitting down and talking to a deacon's wife one time. He had long since quit being a deacon. But she said, I love him so. And I said, why do you love him? She said, he can be so nice. I said, that's in past tense. Let's put it in present tense. What do you love about him right now? And she sat there for about 5 or 10 minutes and she said, not anything. And I said, okay, now you're getting a picture of him. He's out there running around with those other women. What do you think about that? She started to cry. Heartbreak. How's she going to? She had to get a true picture in her mind of what he was really like. Weight control. Now, some of you are overweight. And then we've got Cindy back there. And you know, we just all say, how does she do that? She doesn't eat. She told me, she said, I don't eat much food. And we say, how am I going to stop eating that food? We've got to decide that whatever it is we're eating is not good for us, and we don't want that particular thing to happen to us. Now, if we're just happy with it, we just go right on ahead and don't let it bother us, right? But what does self-control like this have for us in God's kingdom? You know, you're overweight. You say, well, I can still get around. I can still walk. I'm still fine. You say, it may happen to me, but it's far off in the future. And I don't have to worry about it now. But what about in God's kingdom? We don't know when our Lord is going to return. We don't know when we're going to pass from this life. The fundamental principle that Mitchell talks about is to take the heat out of what is in front of me and focus on the consequences of a delay. And the way the scriptures put this is, have you counted the cost? Jesus talked about this required self-control if someone wanted to be his disciple in Luke the 14th chapter, beginning at verse 26. If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not carry his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. For which one of you, when he wants to build a tower, does not first sit down and calculate the cost to see if he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he has laid a foundation and is not able to finish, all who observe it begin to ridicule him, saying, this man began to build and was not able to finish. As you look at that, you immediately realize that there's a terrible situation here. And that is that when you start thinking about it, though, you sit there and you say, I don't want to be ridiculed. I don't want someone to laugh at me by thinking that I'm incompetent in my planning. And so we try to carefully avoid that. Jesus also says in verse 31 of Luke 14, beginning,
Or what king, when he sets out to meet another king in battle, will not first sit down and consider whether he's strong enough with 10,000 men to encounter one coming against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is still far away, he sends a delegation and asks for terms of peace. So then none of you can be my disciple who does not give up all his own possessions. He's talking about self-control, brethren. If you're not willing to control self, you cannot be Jesus' disciple. Basically, you are not. And Paul talks about this. I thought this was tremendously interesting, I guess because Josh has started running long distance, and I always absolutely refuse to do things like that. Everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. They then do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. Therefore, I run in such a way as not without aim. I box in such a way as not beating the air. But I discipline my body and make it my slave. That's self-control, brethren, so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified. Because Josh was out running, I thought, I wonder what it takes to train for a marathon if you read about it on the internet. This is not me doing it. It's reading about it on the internet. And so, you know, you want to run 26.2 miles, right? And you want a good time, so 3 hours and 30 minutes is a good time. And you sit down there and you think about, well, how am I going to run that? It turns out that it takes no less than 2 hours a day. Period. For there are days that you get off, but on days you get off, you're supposed to do cross training and something else, like swimming. You're supposed to do something that will loosen your muscles. And so you're running 3 to 5 miles a day. You know, how long has it been? Well, it's been a long time since I ran a mile. In fact, the last time I remember running a mile, the coach out in New Mexico where we had section lines, that is, they went a mile this way, you could go that way, there were squares. And there were a mile on each side. And we had to jog the first one and walk the second one and jog the third one and then cool down on the fourth one. And that's the last time I've run any miles. 3 to 5 miles, 5 days a week for 3 to 4 months. And then you step it up to 2 days of 8 to 10 miles for 1 to 2 months prior to the end of the race that you're looking at. And in between, you mix in some of those races, longer races. And I thought about that. I thought, there's no way I could do that now, right? Even with all this, I'm too old to do something like that. But when you think of the Christian race, do you think of it in terms of training like this? Immediately you say, well, the Christian race is a marathon. It's something that just never ends. So we've got to keep thinking about it. It just keeps going and going and going. And so we need to prepare. We need to start getting ready. I'm not going to ask for show of hands, but how many of us study 2 hours a day on a regular basis just so that we might run the race that is set before us? If you just read your Bible, in fact, here's a question for you. How many of you have decided this year to read the Bible through? You know, not that big a book. We read lots bigger books than that. You know, if you read about, 10 pages a day, you get through it in 6 months. And you sit there and you say, well, wait a minute. All right, I need to study my Bible. Reading and study are two different things. Pondering their Bible. Thinking about it. 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 15. Is it any wonder? The King James Version there says, study to show thyself approved unto God, a workman who does not need to be ashamed. Rightly dividing the word of truth. Handling it accurately. Using it correctly. How much time do you spend trying to get ready for the race? Now, brethren, I'm not a marathoner and you're probably not either. So the real question is, how much time do we need to spend in order to do this? 5 minutes a day? Now, we've come down to a manageable goal. Does everybody in here read their Bibles 5 minutes a day? Do you want me to have a show of hands by those who don't? No, I wouldn't do that. As you think about reading or studying, God says that if you walk in His way, He will give you self-control. In other words, if you start paying attention to what He says, He'll give you self-control not only in those things which matter for this life to come, but those which matter for this present life. The fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness. And there's our word, self-control. Against such things there is no law. If you're willing to control yourself. You know, it's just, well, it's easy. You just control yourself, right? And when you sat down to eat that meal today, just restrict yourself to 600 calories and see how you like it. That's less than 3 donuts. Not a very good meal. We're all supposed to grow in our self-control. 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 5, Paul says, now for this very reason also applying all diligence, Peter says this, excuse me, in all diligence, in your faith supply, moral excellence, and in your moral excellence, knowledge, and in your knowledge, self-control, and in your self-control, perseverance, and in your perseverance, godliness. You know, self-control comes after diligence, faith, moral excellence, and knowledge. And as I thought about this, surely there's a reason the Holy Spirit arranged these things in this order. It wasn't just, oh well, I'll just put these in there somewhere, and wherever it comes up, that's just fine. Think about it. Our effort, our diligence allows us to study the Word so that we might grow in faith, leading us to desire that moral excellence that we read about. And it's through the knowledge of Him who called us. That knowledge gives us the consequences of having, losing, and keeping control of our lives in all things. Have you counted the cost? You may sit there and say, well, I like cream puffs. I think I'll have a dozen. And if you do that every day, you better change your exercise regimen. I'll tell you, brethren, when I was 19 or so, I moved to California. And they had donut shops everywhere. And I loved them. And I was working as a carpet layer. And so I began eating donuts. I would buy a dozen and I would share them with my aunt and uncle and cousin. My cousin was the first one who told me, she said, don't you bring any more of those things home to me. I'm getting fat. She didn't like that. And then my aunt said, don't you save one of those for me. And my uncle said, don't you save one of those for me. So I had to eat the whole dozen. And I did. But I was young, and I was working as a carpet layer. That's hard work. I didn't gain any weight. And then it came to the rainy season, and I got laid off, and so I started selling furniture. I ballooned up to what I presently weigh. I gained 50 pounds in less than 2 months because I continued to eat my donuts. Okay. Now we know what the cause is. If you're overweight, just stop eating the dozen donuts a day and you can bring it down. Surely, if we know the consequences, we can sit there and say, I don't like this. I'm going to change this in my life. But we have to, in our mind, we have to learn a way to bring our minds under our control rather than just saying, looks good, I'm going to have it. Have you ever thought about what happens? 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 9. If they do not have self-control, let them marry. For it is better to marry than to burn with passion. And when you start thinking about our society right now, these young people that are sitting over here and the young people that are sitting over here, you know that as they're growing, sexuality, it's displayed everywhere. It's the foremost thing that our society thinks about, sexuality, heterosexual and homosexual. You know, it's there. It's out there for everyone to look at. And we say, we can't protect our children from it. What are we going to have to do? We're going to have to teach them self-control. Yesterday on the radio program, I threw this in just because of that. If there's anything that causes divorce more frequently, sexuality and self-control are the root cause. 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 5. He says, stop depriving one another. You don't want to know why they're having so many problems over in the Middle East right now? Turns out you may think they don't have any homosexuals. In fact, President Ahmadinejad told the UN people, he was talking to some reporters at the UN, he said, "We don't have homosexuals in Iran." And they all started laughing, and he said, "You think we do? Show me one, and we won't have it." You knew what he was going to do. He was going to kill him. And so they were going to get rid of it. Stop depriving one another except by agreement for a time that you may devote yourselves to prayer. Some guys have four wives and some guys have none. Turns out about 25% of the young people can't find anyone to marry, and they couldn't settle down because they can't find any jobs. So what are they? They're out there trying to destroy each other. It's what young men do. He says to husbands and wives, devote yourselves to prayer and come together again lest Satan tempt you because of your lack of self-control. You're having a problem in your marriage? I'll tell you the root cause. Self-control. It's because you're not doing what you should, and your wife or your husband is not doing what they should, because somebody lacks self-control. And I want to tell you, brethren, I think it's getting worse. Here's why. I took these from the newspaper on Friday. Talking about the polygamous marriages in Utah. You do realize that if it happened in Utah, that it's now going to happen across the United States, and it will not be long before Maryland decides that, well, sure, one man can have four wives or more, all he wants. The Supreme Court approved, actually by not approving anything, they approved homosexual marriages, and it affected 30 states. Those homosexual marriages are now legal in 30 states just because the Supreme Court did nothing. It was either Wednesday or Thursday. And then we got the good old guy in the white hat out there, and he says, it's not up to me to judge homosexuals. The Pope never read Romans chapter 1 and verse 32. Do you know that our young people are growing so acceptant of homosexual marriage that we're headed for the days of Rome? And I thought it would be a long time when I was young before our society would get that bad, but believe me, or believe the newspapers, or believe Almighty God, it's not going to take long. It's getting worse. I talked with a preacher on Saturday, and I said, did you get affected by that? Oh, no, we're down here in Georgia. We don't have any problems like that. And I said, that's what you think. You may not have now, but I will guarantee you that the next time the Supreme Court takes a look at one of those cases, it's going to apply across the nation. Now, I don't know if you've talked with your representative. I read this in the newspaper yesterday, too. It takes only one representative with guts to file a motion for impeachment of those judges. One. And you may say, well, we don't do things like that. Man, that's why they put that in the Constitution. If you don't like it, you need to change it. Is it happening in our homes? We hope not. Is it happening in our towns? Absolutely it is. We live in a huge one. And everything is happening here. Move to a small one, and guess what? It's happening there too. You know, I was out with a backhoe the other day, and I was digging a hole, and I thought about how long it would take to dig a hole that you could put a Cadillac in. And the reason I was thinking about that is because in my hometown, some good old boys were selling marijuana. Oh yeah, that's legal here too, isn't it? And so they were selling marijuana, and they were growing it in a cornfield. They had corn around the outside and marijuana on the inside, and somebody told the police about it. And that somebody, at least they thought it was the somebody, got buried in his Cadillac in a cornfield because some farmer went out there and dug a hole and they shoved him off in it. My home's town, 12,000. That town was dry when I grew up. There was no alcohol sold. There was a bootlegger there, and he wouldn't sell to the kids. He had moral scruples. The bootlegger had moral scruples. I don't sell to children. You have to be an adult to get a drink here. And we look at these things, and this is why I say I don't think we're getting any better in delaying
gratification. I think we're just changing the standards by which we judge whether or not we've delayed. 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 1, Paul writes, realize this, that in the last days, and we're in those last days, Hebrews chapter 1, verse 1, God, who at sundry times and divers manners has spoken to the fathers and the prophets in times past, hath in these last days, these are the last days, brethren, difficult times will come, for men will be lovers of self. That's not self-control. Lovers of money, boastful, arrogant, revilers. You know what a reviler is? Somebody who threatens somebody all the time. You ever thought about that? Somebody who goes around and, well, you know, parents, hopefully you just don't threaten to beat your children. You think about it. Husbands, don't threaten to beat your wives. You're a reviler. He says they're going to be disobedient to parents. You know, it's truly astounding. I was raised in a furniture store that my parents owned. And my mother was always kind to the people who came into the store. And one day I walked in and she was upset. And I said, what are you so upset about? She said, I had to discipline a little boy today. I said, who's little boy? Had a customer come in, and you know, they had this sofa set up, and these sofas were $1,000 a piece or so, and this was a long time ago. And some little kid was running down the sofas in his heels, in his boots, and his parents wouldn't stop him. And she said, I went over there, and I took him down off of there, and I held him while they shopped. I said, did it upset him? She said, no. We're not teaching our children self-control. We're allowing them to do whatever they want to. And when we do that, they've learned by example. It's okay for them to let me do that. It's okay for me to let anyone else do that. I can do anything I want to. They're going to be unloving, irreconcilable, malicious gossips without self-control, brutal, haters of good. Can you imagine? As we look at this, we say, without self-control. I won't deny myself anything. You know, I had a professor who went through, well, he got his PhD in Amsterdam, but his family fled Berlin. They were wealthy Jews, and he went to live with his grandparents. During World War II, he took his bicycle with his sister, and every day they pedaled out to the tulip fields, and there they picked up the tulip bulbs that had been left in the fields by the farmers, and that was their food. And he said, I told myself that if I ever got out of that situation, I would never again deny myself any food that I thought I would like, because I ate tulips for 4 years. Nothing but tulips. Now, I've never eaten a tulip. I didn't know you could eat a tulip until he told me that he and his sister lived on tulip bulbs. He had no self-control. He was what a clinician would say, he was morbidly obese. And he had a reason for it. He said, I've just found out that I don't want to. I'm just going to live for the present. This life, he didn't believe in God. He was willing to debate it with anybody. He decided there was no God because of what God allowed to happen to him. But let me just point out to you, he was blaming the wrong person. God didn't do it. The men who were involved did. These are difficult times. Brethren, we're going to have to teach our children self-control unless we want them going off into everything that you can imagine. If they're not taught what God says about what they're supposed to use their bodies for and how they're supposed to treat their bodies and how they're supposed to treat their fellow man and how they're supposed to treat the church that Jesus died for, they're not going to know. They're just going to assume, well, you don't have to worry about it. It'll take care of itself. You don't have to do anything for it. It'll take care of itself. And we all know that's not true. I often say churches are fragile things. Brethren, Jesus died for the church. Our children learn by following our example. What do we value in life? What do we hold dear? We serve God when we exhibit self-control, when we realize what is important to us and why it's important and why we should do these things. We're going to have to walk with God. To do so, we're going to have to control ourselves. Notice from 1 John chapter 1, verses 6 and 7. If we say that we have fellowship with Him, that is with God, and yet walk in the darkness, we lie and do not practice the truth.
But if we walk in the light, as he himself is in the light, we have fellowship with one another. And the blood of Jesus, his son, cleanses us from all sin. What a precious thing to be in the body of Christ and to recognize that we can walk with a father. But there are some here today who haven't determined to control their lives by trusting in God. Still doing it your own way. Mark the 16th chapter at verse 15, Jesus told his disciples, "Go into all the world and preach the gospel to all creation. He who has believed and has been baptized shall be saved." That's a simple statement, isn't it? Why would someone argue with it? If you're here today, please don't argue with God. Show self-control. Show humility before him. Show him that you want to follow him and him alone. And if there's any way in which we can help you in being obedient to the gospel, won't you let us know while together we stand and we sing.